Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 130, recorded Saturday, June 24th, 2017. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. One topic on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast, Notes from Hungary. Coming to you today from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois, after a good bit of travel. I think actually the technical unit of measure is slug, as in a slug of travel that I've done recently. We got back home from Hungary. We were there for about 9 days. I got back on the Sunday of Memorial Day weekend, which then gave us that Monday to recover a bit. And then after a short week at home, I was back on the road a week in Richmond, Virginia, and then last week and this week in Atlanta. Some folks wanted me to do what I would call stupid day trips, say up to Michigan from Atlanta for a 90-minute meeting. But in a fit of what was, for me, a rare fit of realism, I said, no, I don't think so. This was the first time, actually, a couple of weeks ago that I'd spent any time in Richmond other than, say, driving around it from maybe Charlottesville to the airport or from D.C. Over to Williamsburg. We were downtown in downtown Richmond, and there are some nice pockets of the town. I was pleasantly surprised, found a couple of restaurants and a microbrewery with a tap room, so I was happy. Even happier because it was just a 20-minute cab ride from the airport and a 10-minute walk to the client. Contrast that to Atlanta, where I just hate having to travel to and from for business. Atlanta, it starts with the location of the airport. At 6 o'clock, say, on the bottom of that I-285 perimeter, and then all of the business is at the opposite side of the city, on the north side of the city, say between 11 and 1 o'clock on the perimeter. And therein lies the most important question that every business traveler faces when they arrive and leave Atlanta. Do I drive through the city or around it? Outside of rush hour, it's not bad. Maybe sort of 35 minutes running up the I-85, I-75 stint up through the city. But when you're trying to catch that 6 p.m. flight home on Thursday night, the trip just sort of starts at an hour long and deteriorates fast. And deterioration is a nice word for last week's trip back after an hour and a quarter drive through the city that would have been a lot worse, except there were three of us in the car. So we got to whiz by the beginnings of the traffic jam in the HOV lanes. And once, though, in the center of the city, the HOV lanes were just as crowded, but it probably cut, I don't know, say maybe 5 minutes off our trip. So then we drop the car off at Hertz, board the SkyTrain, and are on the way to the terminal when the SkyTrain just stops. So we think, okay, well, maybe there's a bit of congestion at the station in front of us. So we wait and wait and wait. No announcement, no nothing. Just wait. 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Finally, somebody near one of the doors presses the phone button, the intercom button. A voice comes on. We're working on it. Thanks for your patience. Click. No reason for the delay. No suggestion on when we'd start back up. Another 5 minutes. Another guy presses the phone button. Same story. After 30 minutes, the train sort of whirs to life and starts to move. And just when I never thought I'd get nostalgic for those car rental buses. Following up, my son Andrew and I flew Austrian Air from Chicago to Budapest last month with an obvious connection in Vienna. A couple of things. First, why Austrian Air? Well, because it was among the cheapest non-budget fares over, and because I could construct an 8-hour layover, which meant we got to spend Saturday eating schnitzel and drinking beer in Vienna. Not a bad thing. We landed at 8:45 Saturday morning. checked our bags in held luggage, and then hopped a cab into the city. It wasn't a cheap cab, probably about 40 euros, but we didn't have time to figure out and wait for the train. So we went first to the Nachtmarkt. I apologize for any German listeners who immediately I've now caused bleeding from the ears. But we went to the Nachtmarkt and met up with a friend of mine, an ex-client and ex-boss who's now running the Polish Development Center for a stealth startup. He had come down Friday night. He said it was a good excuse to spend 3 hours on his new BMW motorcycle. We started out with coffee and then quickly moved to the beer crawl. At noon, we walked into a small place, Gasthaus Pochel, again, apologies to German listeners, just as they were opening. We promised to be out in an hour. We're quick eaters. So they picked up one of the reserve signs, gave us a very nice table, great big plates of schnitzel and glasses of Grüner Veltner. It was great. It was exactly what we wanted in Vienna, and a really, really nice restaurant. I'll post a link to it in the show notes, because if you're in Vienna, I highly recommend it. Anyhow, we needed a bit of a walk after that, big whacking pieces of schnitzel, and then immediately that led to a bit more beer. Then eventually we found a cab back to the airport. It was one of the best layovers I've ever had. And then sort of the second thing on the choice was Vienna Airport. You know, I've whined, and you guys have listened to me whine over the past couple of episodes about how much I don't like Munich Airport. Indeed, one of my O'Hare to Budapest options was on Lufthansa with a connection through Munich. So you can imagine that flight option didn't make the first cut. But Vienna Airport was great. I mean, pleasant folks in the immigration booths, efficient and well-staffed security, nice food and beer selection by the gates. It was, I would call it, the anti-Munich. And the in-air service for Austrian Air, you know, it was pretty good. I mean, it was a fairly new 777-200, you know, typical kind of tight coach seat configuration. Very pleasant, very nice flight attendants. There was nothing that wowed me, but then again, I wasn't expecting anything to. It was a typical coach ticket. So I walked in with kind of low expectations. Indeed, all I wanted was not to be annoyed, not to have a gate agent or flight attendant piss me off. Kind of the, I don't know, the air travel version of the Hippocratic Oath. Do no harm to the passenger. And Austrian Air succeeded. Indeed, if I were to ding them on anything, it would be that the bright red plain upholstery was a bit tough on the eyes. So you can tell I'm kind of digging for something there. I'd fly him again. I liked Austria, and it was a good trip. And actually, I was two for two on airports on the trip to Hungary. Budapest Airport has had a significant upgrade since my last visit, maybe 12 years ago. Again, efficient security lines, bright, clean terminal, good places to grab a coffee and some breakfast. Much more pleasant, I gotta say, than my first time passing through there in 1989 when some army guy was checking that my exit visa had all the right stamps. It was a much happier vibe this time. Two great airport experiences on this trip, though. I think I'll need to consciously ratchet down my expectations for the next trip, where I'll be doing the London twofer, Gatwick and Heathrow, next week. So we know kind of where that one's going to go. You know, thinking through my international travel this year, Paris, Vienna, Budapest, I have to tell you that Google Translate has evolved to being something pretty close to magic. Now, last September, Google made a big announcement that they had moved Translate from a statistics-based approach to a neural network running in Google's cloud on custom hardware. It was the cover story for a New York Times Sunday Magazine article, The Great AI Awakening, using it as a case study of how artificial intelligence will, quote, reinvent computing itself, unquote. And that's all good. And it was a good article. I recommend it. But what really seems like magic is what Google calls Word Lens. When you activate your camera within Google Translate, point it at some text, a menu, or say the washing machine controls in a vacation rental, and you see English words replacing the French or Hungarian words in real time. It's amazingly useful. Saves you from, say, blasting your delicates with hot water or mistakenly ordering chicken when you mix up poulet and poisson after a couple of cocktails. The French translation seemed a bit better than the Hungarian ones, which makes sense when you remember that the quality of the neural network is dependent on the amount of training data, but even the Hungarian was very useful. And Translate lets you download some amount of language data onto your phone so you don't blow through, say, $100 of roaming data trying to avoid Brussels sprouts. As you can tell, it gets a huge Travel Commons endorsement. A few weeks back, I retweeted an NPR story about the proposal to privatize U.S. air traffic control. As someone who has had cumulative months, if not years, wasted on ATC delays, I commented that I can't understand all the angst over this proposal. ATC privatization has worked for years in Canada and Europe, and it's not like the FAA has just sort of bathed itself in glory in trying to upgrade the ATC systems, their next-gen program that was authorized all the way back in 2003. However, Rich Frazier, who's a longtime Travel Commons listener, fellow Midwesterner from Wisconsin, and most importantly, a pilot, came back with a great series of tweets explaining his objections, specifically on privatization's impact on general aviation. I retweeted a number of them if you want to see it in the stream. A couple of the key ones, Rich said, privatization decimated general aviation industries everywhere it was tried. GA is a $200 billion industry here in the U.S., 1.4 million jobs. And then Rich says, and Canada's general aviation industry is a tiny fraction of ours. Apples and oranges don't even begin to describe. And so it was a great point. I was only thinking of the impact of privatization on commercial aviation, which is the only aviation that I experience. Rich's tweets did a nice job of opening the aperture of the discussion to include what is the often unconsidered world, at least for me, of general aviation. Rich, thanks very much for that. And thanks very much for sort of the constructive, informative nature of your tweets. Really appreciate that. And hey, if you have any thoughts, questions, a story, a comment, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email address is comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com. You can use your smartphone to record and send in an audio comment, send a Twitter message like Rich to M. Peacock, or you can post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page or the website at travelcommons.com. So the only topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is notes from Hungary. The flight from Vienna to Budapest is 40 minutes on a 20-seat prop plane. I don't even think it ever levels off. It's just sort of a parabola going straight from climb out into descent. Though not that I really noticed. After one more beer in the Vienna airport, Andrew and I were asleep before the plane left the ground. Yet another pleasant Austrian Air flight attendant graciously placed bottles of water for us in the seat back pocket in front of us. We found them when the plane touched down in Budapest. We've been to Budapest many times before, been to Hungary many times before, but this one would be different. Many of my wife's aunts and uncles had passed away in the 12 years since our last visit, so there weren't as many family obligations, actually just a long Saturday lunch the day before we left. So instead, this was probably the first time we saw Hungary as tourists. So before we visited, we checked with friends who had recently gone to Hungary, and specifically Budapest. And what had they seen? What had they enjoyed? Really, everybody loved Budapest. Scouting out places to stay, we took some advice. We abandoned what had been our usual Budapest Marriott perch on the Danube, and we had been there for many years, and instead headed east to District 7, Erzsébet Város, the old Jewish quarter. During our last visit, which was back in 2005, no one would have thought to go out here, but now it's full of restaurants, craft beer bars, a few Starbucks, and ruined pubs. We actually followed Travel Common listener Arnold Heines's recommendation to check out what is the classic, perhaps the first, ruin bar in Budapest, Simplakert. Arnold's description of it having a pop-up-y kind of feel was right on point. You walk in through a dingy, sort of half-lit hallway, and there are a couple of bars on each side, and then you end up walking into an open, kind of two-story courtyard that was ringed by, I don't know, another half-dozen bars across the two floors. There were at least a couple of English stag parties going on when we walked in, one with whom I assume was the groom-to-be, dressed in a white ballerina tutu. The other group was wearing matching T-shirts fronted with a goofy picture of their groom-to-be. I saw a lot of those while we were in Budapest, party groups wearing matching T-shirts, not so much the ballerina tutus. Budapest, at least the redeveloped district, that District 7 that we were in, seems to have become a fly-in party town. Maybe it was the bankruptcy of the old state-run airline Malév that kind of left a vacuum for budget carriers to fill, including Wizz Air, which has a Budapest hub. And also, Hungary hasn't yet joined the euro, so it can devalue its currency, the forint, and make it look cheap to the rest of Europe. And it had a lot of buildings that were available to repurpose, you know, kind of starting with squatters setting up bars and dance clubs in abandoned buildings, and then redoing things to large sports bars, and then what seemed to be an amazing number of burger places. And they all started filling up Thursday night, mostly with English-speaking parties, a huge change from my first visit again in 89, when seemingly no one but my wife spoke English, and we'd walk into empty restaurants looking for lunch. It was interesting spending money at some of those bars. You'd think that Hungary is moving toward a parallel currency economy, the forint and euro being used interchangeably, which was similar to what I experienced I saw in Vietnam when I'd pay for, say, a single taxi fare. So I'd get out of the taxi and pay the guy in whatever combination of dong and dollar bills that added up to the right number. In Budapest, you'd get a bar tab in forint with a euro number printed below it. And you could pay in euro, but you'd probably end up getting your change back in forint. And if it's not too late in the evening, say maybe your first or second bar, and so you haven't lost your capability to do arithmetic, you'd notice, though, that the euro exchange rate isn't quite in your favor. I started doing math at each bar, which, by the way, seemed to make a couple of bartenders nervous. The range of exchange rates on the bar tab was between sort of 250 to 75 forint to the euro, when the market rate was about 300 forint to the euro. So, in effect, the bars were charging you, say, an 8 to 16% convenience fee for letting you skip the ATM down the street. And maybe that works for you. District 7, though, wasn't the only part of Budapest that's been upgraded. Downtown Pest, along the Danube, definitely looks spiffier. The Parliament building, always an incredibly ornate building that dares you not to take multiple pictures of it as you walked by, looked like it had been sort of freshly steam cleaned. In 89, a soldier shooed my wife and I off the steps when we tried to take pictures. This time, though, we walked down into a nice visitor center, bought some tour tickets, were escorted up the golden staircase under the huge dome, past the crown jewels. It was absolutely a great tour. And further south along the river, sort of new developments, plazas, bars, bike paths have all sprung up, again, in places we wouldn't have thought of going 12 years ago. And walking down what had been the main shopping street, Váci utca, kind of at the southern end of Váci utca, it had gotten a little seedy. There was a time when I walked past, they had kind of girl strip clubs, dancing bars, and you would always get propositioned as you walk down that end of the street. All that's gone. Now it's all been cleaned up, all nice shops. I understood why friends who had visited over the past year really enjoyed it. And then as much as I like knocking around Budapest and running through most of the District 7 craft bars, where, as you can imagine, we enjoyed them, and according to Untappd, Andrew and I tasted 43 Hungarian beers, which that says something right in and of itself about the beer scene, not necessarily us. Or maybe it says something about—anyhow, my favorite bit of the trip was the day we spent visiting wineries in the Tokaji wine region, which is about 2.5 hour northeast, 2.5 hour drive northeast of Budapest, near the border with Slovakia. So we had hired a guy who runs the Tokaji Today website as our guide. So we drove out the Sunday afternoon, and then Monday he came to our hotel. English translation of his first name would be Greg. I'm not going to try the Hungarian. So Greg came to our hotel, gave us a 30-minute PowerPoint presentation. He plugged right into the hotel's flat-screen TV in the breakfast room and ran us through Tokaji's history, geography, geology, grape and wine types. And then with this intro to Tokaji information still looking sort of for neurons to hang out in our brains, we were, boom, off to visit four winemakers. And I say winemakers rather than wineries, because we sat down with each of the winemakers, two more established, Zoltan Demeter and Judith Bodo, in their wine rooms, in their tasting rooms, and then two, you know, what the French would call garagistas, sort of people making wine in their garages, but it was a little bit more upscale than that, but still in their homes, and we were sitting there in their kitchens and their patios, each of them, you know, for about an hour or more, talking about their wine, about Hungary, about what they're trying to do. Only one of the four, Demeter, is from Tokaji. The rest moved there to make wine. Bodo from the Hungarian-speaking part of Slovakia, Peter from Budapest, and Hulat, I think it was like Matilda, or would be the English pronunciation of her first name, from France, because of, and they were all just sort of drawn by Tokaji's history and really the potential to make great wine. And each of them told the same story of Tokaji's history, wine knowledge, wine quality being broken during the 40-some years of communism, abandoning the high-quality vineyards on the hills for lower-quality fields on the plains that could be harvested with the big Russian tractors they were getting from the Soviet Union, the five-year government planning that pushed quantity over quality, that whole centralized planning thing in communist countries. And then they talked about how each of them came to Tokaji to flip that equation back to quality over quantity. Even the Tokaji local, Demeter, had to leave Tokaji for jobs in California and France in those vineyards to learn quality winemaking before he came back. But they all feel challenged to get the entire community, the locals, on board. I don't know. Maybe it's, you know, some of the residue of communism. It's easier to crank out industrial plonk than good wine. Maybe it's because many of them can't afford these new wines and so don't appreciate them. Bodo said she specifically priced one wine so that local young people who now drink beer could afford to drink good local wine. To appreciate what they have here, she said, everyone has to be able to enjoy good wine, not just the winemakers. You know, I hate to truck in the wine industry cliche, the wine writers cliche, that these winemakers have a passion for what they're doing, but I got to tell you, my thesaurus fails me on this one. I couldn't find a better word for it. And spending that day with those folks, they all appreciated that we'd taken the time to drive out from Budapest to visit. If, you know, maybe they were a bit puzzled by doing everything in a day, that whole idea of the American flash vacation just didn't resonate. But they were very generous with their time and their wine, given the trip that we had made. It was tough to limit ourselves to buying only just, you know, one bottle per stop. I had to keep reminding myself, though, that I'd only brought my small roller board with me. On our last night, we were back in Budapest, knocking around District 7 again, looking for our last dinner. We had had some great food, a couple of Michelin one-star restaurants, and also some food trucks near a ruined bar, but it was tough to find some of the homey Hungarian food, I don't know, call it peasant food, that we had had in last and in previous visits. And then we found it in this little, it wasn't that little, but this one restaurant, walked in. It was a bit cafeteria style. You walked in, there was kind of glass counters. You could see all the food, and then you selected. They put it on trays, and then you walked over and went to your table. I guess we would call that fast casual here in the U.S. But I said, oh well, wait, I'll take that sausage, the hurka with the pork liver and rice. And that one too, the regular kolbas with pork and paprika and garlic and a bit of that, pickled salad over there and a bowl of goulash soup. And all right, I'll just have one last beer. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 130. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Check out the show notes for music links and also other random links that I remember to put in. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher. But then again, if you're listening, you've already found us. So why am I saying that? I don't know. Maybe so you can forward this to some friends. If you have a story, thought, comment, or gripe, or a different opinion like Rich, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comment, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, M. Peacock on Twitter, the Travel Commons page on Facebook. Post them on the website at travelcommons.com. There are all sorts of ways. Thanks to everyone who has taken time to send in emails, tweets, and post comments on the website. I'm heading out. I got to do some quick editing and post-production on this because I'm heading out tomorrow late afternoon for London, be out there for a week. Didn't have a lot of lead time for this trip, so the prices were fairly ugly, but British Airways, I found an itinerary on British Airways that worked. But it's interesting that the ticket is on British Airways, but I'm not flying any British Airways metal. The flight from O'Hare to Gatwick is on Aer Lingus by way of Dublin. So I'll have, it's been a while since I've connected through Dublin, so that'll be interesting. And then the way back is Heathrow to O'Hare direct, but on a new American Airlines 787 Dreamliner, which I have not flown before, and I'm pretty excited about experiencing that new metal. I'll have some comments on that on the next podcast. But until we talk again, travel safe, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.